State versus Corey Rector. This is 20 AP 1213 CR. Appearances, please.
State appears by good cause.
All right. 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, please proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. As I stated, my name is Wynn Collins, counsel for the state as the cross-appellant and respondent. The state respectfully requests that this court reverse the post-conviction order that denied lifetime sex offender registration and remand with instruction to impose lifetime registration. This appeal concerns the meaning of the term separate occasions, and that is a term that this court defined in the habitual criminality statute. So the question before this court is whether separate occasions has a harmonious or contradictory meaning. Before considering this question, it's important to know what the parties do not dispute to help focus the issue before this court. First, the constitutionality of the sex offender registration statute is not at issue. Second, as this court explained in Bolling, sex offender registration does not constitute punishment, though it does impact the reintegration needs of an offender and does impose some burden. And third, the parties agree that Rector must register as a sex offender. As he states on page 30 of his brief, he has to register under his own interpretation until he is 67 years old. So the only question is whether it is that period or life. We have a narrow issue here on the meaning of separate occasions, but the parties approach the issue very differently. The state can respect that Mr. Rector has an interest in registering as short as possible. The state isn't concerned with the policy question how long he must register. That is a legislative question. The state operates here in the executive branch, and so our interest is to effectuate the will of the legislature. Our concern, our objective, is preserving our uniform system of laws. This court should reverse and remand, because canons of statutory interpretation and fidelity to the legislative enactment dictates that Rector must register for life.
Mr. Collins, one of the questions that Mr. Rector brings up in his brief is that in your brief, you didn't talk about the plain language of the separate occasions when you are analyzing 301.45.5b1. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Yes, Your Honor. The state did look to plain language principles. The state relied and looked at this court's interpretations in Whitrock and Hopkins. What's important to note in Whitrock is this court applied plain language analysis. It went to the dictionary definition for occasions and said that it means happening or incident. The problem on why there was ambiguity is it doesn't tell us what that thing is. It doesn't tell us what the incident is. It doesn't tell us what the happening is. Is it the date of the offense? Is it the date of the conviction? Is it the date of the court hearing?
How about we just look at the language? On two or more separate occasions, been convicted. Doesn't that tell us what has to have happened? And what work does been convicted do if you want us to just think about occasions in the random universe of things occasions could be?
Yes, Your Honor. That's precisely what this court did in Whitrock and Hopkins and what occurs here. And we know from statutory interpretation principles like in Kalal that structure is important to meaning. And so it is not that we can't look to a dictionary and find out what separate means and what occasion means. The problem is it doesn't tell us what the incident is, what the happening is. It doesn't tell us whether it is the occasion being a conviction, the occasion being the crime, the occasion being the sentencing date.
Aren't we past that analysis, though, if we apply the prior construction canon, which I think is the gist of your argument, right? And isn't that canon part of the plain meaning analysis? Because this court has already definitively construed decades ago the meaning of that word.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If we looked in a vacuum, it may be ambiguous, but we have the benefit of Whitrock and Hopkins, which provided meaning to that term.
And we're past the point of dealing with ambiguity in this case, aren't we, because of that definitive construction this court has already placed on that word?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The term has a legally understood meaning, and in canons of statutory interpretation, if a term has a legally understood meaning, then that is the meaning that is applied. And to Your Honor's point, what is important here is the unique posture that this case comes before it, and that is the presumption that's critical here. And the reason that is so important is we have to look at the context and history. This court decided Whitrock in 1984. It decided Hopkins in 1992. The legislature didn't even have a sex offender registration statute at the time. That first came about in 1993, and the initial act was essentially a one-size-fits-all approach in 1993, Wisconsin Act 98. Everyone reported for 15 years, so there was no need to distinguish between convictions. But in 1995, Wisconsin Act 440, the legislature created the bifurcated sex offender reporting requirement. It began as Senate Bill 182 by Senator Alberta Darling and quickly gained nearly unanimous support, I believe passing out of the Senate 30-3 and the Assembly 99-0. And under the principle that the legislature acts with a harmonious structure of laws, the legislature has the benefit of this court's interpretations of Whitrock. It has the benefit of this court's interpretation of Hopkins.
Do you know how many times the legislature has used the expression separate occasions in any penal or criminal statutes?
I believe it is only these two instances at the time it was passed. There was a more recent amendment of a domestic abuse repeater that used the phrase separate occasions, and it's pretty obvious from the structure and the context that the legislature was going for the same meaning there as in the habitual criminality statute. It's an interesting phrase because it's not found a lot in the statute. What's a little curious about Rector's argument is he draws this court to a different statute in 125 dealing with obtaining alcohol licenses that says you have to publish on three successive occasions. Now, it's a bit unusual to tell this court that it should interpret separate occasions in the sex offender registration statute using a different phrase, successive occasions on publishing notices to alcohol licenses. And what's important is that Alcohol Licensing Act was also enacted before the court used the term separate occasions in the sex offender registration statute. So the legislature knew the law. It had different terms it could choose. It could choose successive occasions, already on the books. It could choose separate occasions, already on the books and already interpreted by this court.
So you are saying that do we even have any idea how many statutes there are?
Well, we know we have six volumes that don't all fit in that
six
book.
Six volumes that don't all fit. So you want us to say that in a situation, in a case, two cases, so two incidents involving one statute, that somehow, that was deemed to be ambiguous, that the legislative history was used and looked at to determine in that context, that we're going to assume that the legislature pours through every single statute to find that one other statute, and that they're going to know exactly what that language is, and that that's what they did when they created the statute. I mean, that's really what you're asking us to determine.
Yes, Your Honor, although there's two key points that I might phrase a bit differently than you have. So let's start with the presumption. Like any good presumption, it can be overcome, but the burden is on the party who wants contradiction in the law to overcome it. So the presumption is we have a harmonious system of laws. So it's not that you can't overcome it. In fact, there was an example where this court did interpret two statutes to have different meanings, but that is after you overcome the presumption.
That's if you say that makes that one prior statute in a book of thousands of statutes makes for a harmonious system of laws. You've made a presumption to start with right there.
Well, I didn't make that presumption, Your Honor. This court unseated that presumption in State versus Luce in 1903. This court has repeatedly relied on the presumption. In fact, this year, in State versus Yakich, this court relied on the presumption. The state isn't creating this presumption. This presumption goes back to the dawn of our state.
Well, I understand, but you want us to insert that presumption here with one prior statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't want to insert it. I want to follow the canons that this court has said. It says we start with the presumption for a knowledge of the law and harmony in the law until it's overcome by history or context. So if Rector wanted to point to history or context to overcome the presumption, he could, but he didn't. In fact, he completely ignores the presumption other than a single cursory reference in his brief that, yes, we presume the legislature knows the law. So that's the point, first point, Your Honor. The second point...
Well, let's stay on that first point. In fact, the first point also is the point you make on page 6 of your reply brief, but exactly what you are arguing. And you say the statutory analysis begins with the presumption that the legislature knew the case law and existence at the time it changed the statutes. And you were just talking about a 1903 case. You cite for the premise in your brief a 1999 case. But all of those, I think, are pre-K-law, if I have that right. And K-law makes it clear. I mean, if it isn't talk about a term of art. If it isn't axiomatic now, statutory interpretation analysis begins with the language of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, let's talk about K-law.
Well, no, let's talk about your saying the statutory analysis begins with the presumption that the legislature knew the case law in existence at the time it changed the statutes. I say, under K-law, and a myriad of cases that all of us have written, says to the contrary, that the statutory analysis begins with looking at the language of the statute. How do you reconcile who's on first? Then let's get to what's on second that you want to talk about.
All right, well, let's start with who's on first. And forgive me, Chief Justice, but I'm going to cite to a dissent you had as recently as in 2019, Milwaukee District Council 48, where you cited and quoted a passage from the Court of Appeals Blaskovich decision, Court of Appeals decision from 1999. Those are the cases that say you begin with the presumption. Now, it is true in most cases, if you don't have an identically used phrase that has been previously interpreted, in abstract, you start with the presumption, but it doesn't do much good, right? It matters when you have the unique posture here that you have an interpreted phrase, the legislature using that phrase. So, and I want to be clear, the dissent had nothing to do with that you don't start with the presumption. The Chief Justice was dissenting on the substance, but relying on the very premise that you begin with a presumption. And I actually thought through this when writing my brief. How can you start anywhere but a presumption? You don't do all your analysis and then get to a presumption. A presumption is your default setting on a computer, right? You turn it on, it's going to have these defaults, and then a party has to overcome it. So that is first base. Now let's move to second base, Kalal.
Well, it could be. I'm telling you, in reality, for me, might be different from my colleagues. When I have a case involving statutory interpretation, I always look first at the words of the statute. That's the way I do it. I think that's the way that K-law says you do it. We have a disagreement. The reason I laugh is we have a little disagreement on how you pronounce that name.
Well, there's a right way and a wrong way.
Well, that's right. I generally engage in the wrong one.
Your Honor, we start with binding precedent. And we have binding published precedent that says you start with the presumption. So you'd have to overturn either that precedent.
Well, the precedent, you referred to a dissent of my colleague. I'll have to take a look at that because I am confident I can show you. Don't say I'm too long, too quick, but I'm confident that I can show you a number of opinions where all of us have said you begin under K-law with the words of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. So let's harmonize those, right? So we have binding precedent, not just the dissent by the Chief Justice, but an actual binding case, Blaskovich, that says you start with the presumption. We also have, you're right, lots of cases talking about plain language, you start with the statute itself. Those are not contrary to one another, because to engage in the presumption, to do the analysis, you have to do what? You have to look to the language of the statute. So you're doing these simultaneously. The question is whether you can overcome the presumption. And that takes us to Kalal. So this is sort of a merger of Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's point and Justice Dallas' point. Let's look to Kalal.
K-Law.
K-Law, sorry. K-Law.
Justice Kurofsky has definitively construed the pronunciation.
Well, I'll defer to Justice Kurofsky on pronunciation.
I'll defer.
Counsel, I'd actually like to... I don't have a problem with the idea of, you know, this court, and I've written on this as well, and the court is certainly true that when this court authoritatively, you know, construes a phrase and the legislature uses it, we presume that it's using that to mean the same thing, you know, unless there's some contextual clues or things that would suggest otherwise. My question is about the prior cases here. Be frank, they don't go through the kind of textual analysis that maybe would be more expected today. They look and say, well, there's a couple of ways you could read this. We think it's ambiguous. I can't think of a maybe there is, but it's kind of odd. And then what the court does is look and say, what do we think the purpose or intent of the statute is? And so we're just going to read the language, we think, to further whatever we understand the legislative purpose to be. That's an odd kind of conclusion to say the court has authoritatively construed the phrase to mean X, you know, in that situation, or that it always means separate convictions. Because we said we have no idea what it means. But in the context of this particular statute, in the particular aims of this statute, we think, this is the way we're going to construe it in this context. So I have a hard time looking at the prior cases and seeing, and I get your argument. I mean, there's something to it. I'm not totally disagreeing with the idea that there's been some interpretation that's gone on. But normally in these kinds of cases, we see, you know, a use of a legal term of art or a phrase that, you know, then has a definitive meaning. And our prior cases don't say that. They don't say that about this particular phrase. They don't seem to give it a clear meaning that always means separate convictions. They very much have a contextual, this particular statute, it's ambiguous, and let's look at the purposes of the statute to figure out what we think it means here.
2 points to that, Your Honor. First, going back to Hopkins and Whitrock and two other legal principles that we have to also examine here. One is legislative acquiescence and the other is judicial constraint. So legislative acquiescence is that if the legislature goes in and amends a statute after this court has interpreted it and doesn't change this court's meaning, the legislature has embraced this court's meaning. And then the other side of the coin is judicial constraint. This court cannot reinterpret. It doesn't get a do-over because it has now effectively properly interpreted the will of the legislature. Why is that relevant to the...
Well, let me just push back a little bit. I mean, if you understood what I'm saying here is I'm not sure this court has authoritatively construed the phrase separate occasions to mean separate convictions. I don't see that in our cases. We didn't say that this is what this phrase means. We said it's ambiguous, so we're going to look to the specific context of the repeater statutes and figure out what we think the legislative purposes were, and then try to construe that phrase in a way that most effectuates those purposes. That was the analysis done in those cases. It was not an authoritative construction of a phrase creating a legal term of art that's then replicated as we normally see the phrase, you know, clearly adopted. So the second point, I mean, obviously, if we've said that and then it's used, I agree with you, and we've said that in other cases, if that's what the term means. My question to you is the cases don't seem to do that to me.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that why we have to look at the history. So we know that the legislature has acquiesced to this court's interpretation of the habitual criminality statute, and the reason we know that is the legislature has amended that statute about 18 times since Whitrock and Hopkins. Two of those amendments are particularly noteworthy, 1993 Wisconsin Act 289 and 1997 Wisconsin Act 326. The reason I draw the court to those two is the legislature added definitions to the habitual criminality statute. One was a definition for serious felony, the other was serious child sex offense. The legislature, in 18 amendments to habitual criminality, has never altered this court's interpretation of separate occasions. So we know what it means in that context. Now getting to this court's point about what does it mean in the sex offender registration statute. And we have to do nothing more than look at regular statutory interpretation principles because structure is important to meaning. And so we look to the structure of the sex offender registration statute and we look to the structure of the habitual criminality statute. And what we see is the same operative structure. Both statutes do essentially three things. They have a person. In one case, it's identified as a person. In the other case, it's identified as an actor. They both have a verb. In one case, it has been convicted, and in the other statute, it was convicted. And then they both have what is the triggering event. In one case, it's three separate occasions. In one, it's two or more separate occasions. So the fact that they have the exact same operative structure of counting priors is why these two statutes are married under the presumption.
I'll just tell you that if I were just doing a straight, plain reading of this, I think your position's wrong. If I read the statute, just in any ordinary use of English, put the cases aside for a minute, it makes no sense to me to say on two or more separate occasions been convicted to mean two or more separate convictions been convicted. The legislature doesn't write things like that. The occasions, you know, seems to have a temporal concept. So convince me how you're correct if I think your plain reading is pretty plainly incorrect.
Thank you, Your Honor. You would have to severely undercut the judicial constraint precedent that the court doesn't get a mulligan. This isn't golf. We can't redo over Hopkins and Whitrock. So what we have to do is look at the same analysis. The problem is that separate occasions doesn't explain what the occasion is in either statute. It doesn't say the date of the offense. It doesn't state the date of violation. And in terms of Whitrock and Hopkins in relation to K-law. Sorry about that.
Hard A.
Is it's important to know what that opinion did not do. That opinion did not change plain meaning analysis. It didn't change the ambiguity test. In fact, one point that I have to emphasize is in Rector's brief, I think it's paragraph 47, where he does a block quote of the ambiguity test. He conspicuously leaves off the cases cited to, including a case, State versus Bruno, where this court cites to a 1969 decision laying out the ambiguity test. And the reason that's important is in Whitrock, it cites to another case, quoting to that same very case. It's the exact same ambiguity test. Both Whitrock and Kalal have cited to the same 1969 ambiguity test. Now, I don't know why Rector didn't want to talk about Bruno when he filed his brief in April. A lot of people didn't want to talk about Bruno.
We don't talk about Bruno.
But we have to talk about Bruno here because Kalal didn't change the ambiguity test. It didn't change the plain meaning test. Now, absolutely, it's a critical case in resolving when you look to secondary sources to resolve statutory ambiguity. But in fact, Kalal also cited in the plain language analysis to a 1967 case. One thing this court was very clearly doing was getting back to the core cases on statutory interpretation.
Just on the ambiguity, though, counsel, there definitely has been a movement in the way we analyze texts and think about ambiguity. It is quite common in cases of that vintage, I think, even 20, 30 years ago, to read cases, say, there's two readings. Okay, it's ambiguous. Now we're going to go and we're going to look at the, off the case, we'll talk about legislative intent, and we're going to construe the statute to effectuate a purpose. And there's a lot of cases that look like that. You don't see that very often nowadays. And I think there's definitely been a movement, one which I think is quite a good one, to do the hard work of not just saying there's two good arguments, let's throw up our hands and try to effectuate the purpose, but to say what's the best reading, what's the most reasonable reading of that. So agreed, we haven't changed the ambiguity test, but I think we've narrowed it to a much more narrower class of cases, and not just when you can make good arguments either way, or else every statute we read at this court would probably be considered ambiguous.
And that might be fine, Your Honor, if the legislature had created the sex offender registry before Whitrock and Hopkins, but you will have to not only disband Whitrock and Hopkins, you have to undermine the legislative acquiescence doctrine, you have to undermine the judicial constraint doctrine, because the legislature used that term in a new legislative enactment after this court's interpreted it.
Isn't it more than legislative acquiescence? Don't we have some, no one mentions stare decisis here in the briefing, I don't think. But don't we have a legislature that is relying on this court's definitive interpretation going back decades as it enacts subsequent legislation? And now it seems that to accept the defendant's argument, which is probably right if we were starting from square one and looking at plain language, as Justice Hagedorn has pointed out, the prior courts did not do a proper analysis. There's no doubt about it. But I guess the question is, do we shed all precedent that preexisted K-law that did not do a proper textual analysis? Do we overturn every single case that predates K-law, even when the legislature has, I think the legislative history confirms this, has relied on this court's interpretation of that language?
You're right, Your Honor. We don't do that because it undermines our sound system of laws, and that gets us back to even a greater issue than the presumption where we started. And it gets to the fact that the legislature is doing its job on the policy question of how long a person must register. This court is doing its job interpreting a statute. And the timing and context is critical here because this isn't a case where the legislature just used that term throughout the statutes willy-nilly. This court interprets the term. And I think the timing matters, that it's a 1992 decision, a 1984 decision, shortly before the legislature saying we need to create this new statute counting convictions in a different context, but really the same operative structure. And we know operative structure is important to meaning.
So you said that this phrase is used in a few places. The first place is where we initially interpreted it 30 years ago or so, and that was in the context of a repeater. Second is sex offender. The third was a domestic statute. What is that statute?
Your Honor, in 939, it's a 6-2, and I forget where it was tucked in, so it's right near the habitual criminality statute, was a designation of a repeat domestic abuser where they use the same phrase, separate occasions, to denote priors. I see my time has expired.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. As some of the justices have pointed out today, the plain meaning of the language of the statute seems to point to Mr. Rector's interpretation. And if you start with that plain language, you can also end there. The state has not tried to offer a competing reading that grammatically makes sense that would support its position on what the law is. Now, sticking to plain meaning isn't an intellectual exercise. It's a rule of interpretation. It's the primary canon, but it's more than that. Courts strive to apply the plain meaning of the statutes as written because those words are the law, and not in an abstract sense. They're the law that's available to everyone, the law that's available to judges to apply, the law that's available to legislators to vote on, the law that's available to lawyers to litigate, negotiate in the shadow of. And most importantly, it's the law that applies to all of us. And the imperative to apply the plain meaning is especially clear here. The state's reading of the law is founded in a 2017 opinion of the Attorney General. That opinion was issued 22 years after this law went into effect. It beggars belief to imagine that people who were negotiating plea bargains or deciding whether to enter a plea were not reading the plain language of that statute and believing that they would be required to register for 15 years. And now the state is here asking this court to tell the people who took that bargain that based on the state's interpretation, and the state, of course, is the other side of that bargain has suddenly changed, sometimes many, many years after the fact. This is why courts strive to apply plain meaning. Because we don't want to have people rely on the words of the statute and then be blindsided by an interpretation that does not adhere to those words. Now, the state has spoken of legislative acquiescence, and it's really kind of hitched its wagon to legislative acquiescence, and Justice Bradley asked some questions about it as well. I would say that the presumption that they're relying on here, that the state is relying on, is sort of a species of legislative acquiescence.
Mr.
It's not,
Nicol, yes. I want to go just back to what you just said, because you just said that they would rely on that 15 years, but under there is a statutory provision that would allow the judge the judge wouldn't be stuck. No matter what, the judge would have discretion.
That's absolutely the case. Okay. The judge always has discretion.
So help me understand your argument then in that light. I mean, you're saying, look, they bargained for this, but it's not that the ceiling was 15 years. The ceiling has always been a lifetime registration. So I'm not sure.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I guess my response would be people routinely bargain for sentencing recommendations from the prosecutor, even though they know that the judge is not bound by those either. If that was in fact never a possibility, if this court decides that they never could have received 15 years, again, many, many years after the fact, some people, you know, may well be even off paper, off of supervision. That will be taking away a benefit that they bargained for. They were fortunate enough to actually receive it from the judge, but it is something for which they bargained, the chance at it. Getting back to the legislative acquiescence issue, this court has actually said that that's an important aid to interpretation, but it does not overcome plain meaning. It said it in the case of Wenke versus Gell Company in 2004. That's 274 with second 220. And that makes sense. There may be many, many reasons why the legislature has not changed a law after this court interpreted it. But even if we allow that the legislature saw Whitrock and saw Hopkins, if we presume that they understand this court's cases, they would understand that those cases did not purport to define the term separate occasions always and forever in every place in the statute. As Justice Hagedorn has pointed out, they rushed into a determination of ambiguity, and then they looked to the legislative history of 939.62. You will search those cases in vain for the notion that separate and occasion always means essentially nothing, which is what the state says it means here.
Counsel, you cite a 2004 case addressing legislative acquiescence argument advanced by your opposing counsel. Is that the same, and I haven't read that case, but of course I have read Kalal, and you know, it discusses that that's a 2004 decision, that's why it comes to mind. You quoted another one. But Kalal, after saying that the Wisconsin statutory interpretation case law has evolved in something of a combination fashion generating some analytical confusion, tries to take, I guess you take the bull by the horns, is that what you do? Anyway, tries to address this. And, of course, then says we've repeatedly held that statutory interpretation begins with the language of the statute. But a sentence or two, maybe the sentence right before that, is this in 2004. It is the enacted law, not the unenacted intent, that is binding on the public. How does that fit into the legislative acquiescence argument, if at all?
I embrace that sentence of Kalal. In this case, the legislative history for this statute really doesn't get us very far. The state relies on it somewhat in its brief. If you look at the memorandum on which it's relying, it uses a few different phrases. It says, two or more sexual offenses, which the state, of course, puts its flag on that, but it also says repeat sex offenders, and it also says two or more separate convictions. So what work is separate doing? And according to the state's view, it's doing none. So I really don't think that the legislative history is helpful here. And that's, you know, of course, we don't turn under Kalal. We don't turn to legislative history unless we've already decided that the statutory language is ambiguous, which, again, the state is really, really not offering a competing reading, so it's hard even to get there.
Well, legislative history can confirm a plain meaning analysis. Do you dispute that the prior construction canon is part of the plain meaning analysis? In other words, if this court has, and I understand you dispute that fact, but if this court has, in fact, definitively construed a phrase to mean something and the legislature uses it in a related statute, it takes on the meaning that this court said it has.
I would accept that with some reservation. First of all, I guess it depends a lot on your terms. What is a term of art? You know, deciding whether something is a term of art is not, it's not an on-off switch. There are certainly there are words that the legislature uses, because of course they use ordinary language, that this court may have occasion to construe. But sometimes language is just so ordinary that it's hard to imagine that suddenly this court has taken all of the common meaning that we would understand from that term in the course of deciding a particular case out of that term. But no, I agree with you that, I forget the phrase that you used, but that is part of statutory construction. I think it's a little bit slippery as to exactly where it falls. The state is pushing the notion that it's actually before plain meaning, which is a position that I guess I've never heard articulated. I do not agree with that. I think that this court's prior interpretations that the legislature can be shown to have relied on may inform ideas about meaning. I don't believe that they trump plain meaning itself.
Do you think that, and I think it's almost indisputable, that the prior construction the courts in 84 and 92 gave to this term did not follow the proper framework and are probably wrong?
Yeah, yes, I do.
Do we shed all of our pre-K law precedent that didn't follow the proper analysis and reach the wrong conclusion, because that would substantially undermine the doctrine of stare decisis, and more importantly, it would create a great instability in the law?
No, of course this court doesn't. You know, K law didn't hit the reset button for all prior case law. However, that's not what Mr. Rector is asking this court to do. The question for this court is whether it's going to take that, I think, more or less concededly erroneous construction and apply it to a totally new area of the statutes. It doesn't need to do that for the reasons I've articulated and for some of the reasons that Justice Hagedorn has articulated. Whitrock and Hopkins did not purport to, again, define that phrase forever and always. I don't think even the state has suggested that stare decisis binds this court, because it's interpreting a different statute, and this court has said that that's the same phrase can have different meanings in different statutes. In fact, it's common that the same phrase does have different meanings in different statutes.
Where do we draw the line then with the prior construction canon? Because it isn't, as I've studied it, it isn't limited to the particular individual statute in which a phrase was construed. It may not carry through the entire corpus of the statutes, but it does have application beyond that particular statute. For example, if the statutes are related. So is your best argument on that score that these statutes are sufficiently distinct, unrelated, that you would not carry, or we should not carry, that meaning beyond the statute in which it was accorded?
I guess I'd have two answers to that. First, I don't think that the statutes are terribly closely related. It's clear that they don't interact in any practical sense. This court will not create any logistical problems in construing this statute in a different way than it construed 939.62. I don't think they're terribly closely related. I don't think there's a strong imperative on this court to harmonize, as the state says, the statutes. There's no harmony or disharmony to be had here. They work fine either way. I guess I can't draw a line for you, but I can suggest, I think, a principle, which is that some terms are necessarily recognizable as terms of art. There are all sorts of legal terms, terms that we all know in this room, but almost no one else ever uses. There are terms that are used in the statutes that clearly have a particular meaning based on their context. But I don't think that ordinary terms typically become terms of art simply because this court has once or twice looked at them and said they mean a particular thing in this instance.
Where's the phrase separate occasions used? Where else is it used?
So I don't have a definitive answer for that. I second everything the state has said. I think it might pop up one time in the animal control statutes, but I think that's it. It's not a common phrase. The word separate and the word occasions both pop up very many times, but this particular phrase is fairly limited in its use. The state also talks about judicial constraint. It said that this court doesn't get, I think it said, a mulligan. I'd just like to push back a little bit on that. For the reasons I've said, I don't think it's a mulligan. I think we're talking about a different statute. This court is free to interpret it as the words of the statute compel. But there's a different kind of judicial restraint which is inherent in the notion of plain meaning, really. And that notion is that the legislature makes the laws. The court doesn't expand the realm of people who are covered by the laws. And this principle is reflected in the doctrine of plain meaning. It's reflected in the doctrine of the rule of lenity. It's reflected in the doctrine of vagueness. It's reflected in the notice part of due process. So I do think that, you know, this court can certainly fulfill its proper role by leaving to the legislature to decide to write plain words and to simply apply those plain words as written.
Counsel, even though I don't think these prior cases, at least as I currently am thinking through it, have authoritatively construed that phrase, I do think there is some tension between reading the statute as it seems to plainly read and the language in these other statutes. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about, you've just touched on this a little bit, but I guess I want you to expand on it, about how we should or should not deal with that or address that in addressing the statute at issue for your client in this case.
Sure. I mean, I agree with you. Certainly, it's a strange thing for me to be asking of this court that it take a phrase and say it means something different than it said it meant some years ago, even though, again, there are various distinctions between the cases, context, et cetera. To me, the question is, what's more important? Is it more important that this court sort of adhere rigidly to the things that it has said before, even if there are reasons that those cases can be distinguished? Or is it more important that this court apply the plain meaning of statutes that the legislature writes? And I think it's clearly the latter. You know, Justice Scalia said something in a concurrence. You know, we assume that all people are charged with knowledge of the criminal law, right? We assume that people can read the statutes and can understand what's criminalized. Now, that's a bit of a legal fiction. Most people don't, you know, read the law before they go rob a bank. But it's foundational to the idea of our legal system. And then he goes on to say, but that legal fiction, you know, descends into farce when we imagine that people are reading committee reports, which is essentially what the state is asking us to do. And I won't go so far as to say it would be farce for someone to look at Whitrock and Hopkins before giving away their constitutional rights in a deal with the state. But I do think, again, it's far more important that we adhere to the idea that the law is not, you know, is not going to blindside people who simply read the words of the statute. I think that's the more important value here.
I actually have one more question on the other issue in this case that we haven't.
Oh.
And that's just a quick procedural question. So the trial court in the sentencing here said that he was not eligible for the substance abuse program statutorily. I think that's what happened in the first sentencing hearing.
Correct.
Then trial court says in subsequent post-conviction motion, I wouldn't have given it to him anyway because for the way I process through this. I understand part of your argument here that there was a preset frame of mind. I have a little bit more unique question here, and I'd be interested in the state has thoughts on this as well, and that is, to what extent can the trial court look at the post-conviction motion, or to what extent should we as a reviewing court look at the post-conviction motion for a different rationale than originally given at the sentencing hearing? We've looked at post-conviction motions, I'm aware of, to expand or further elucidate or further clarify. And maybe this is obvious and I just don't know it, but how should we look at when there's maybe a different reason that's given? Can it be corrected on a post-conviction motion if there was an erroneous reliance on the idea that this was used statutorily ineligible. Even if he clarifies later, I wouldn't have done it anyway. And if we assume, contrary to your argument, that would have been a proper exercise of discretion. For my purposes, I'm just curious about how to think through that as a reviewing court.
You know, that's the first time I've thought about that in relation to this case anyway. I do think it's a problem to have the circuit court come in and say, well, actually, I was thinking something completely different. Or that's not even really what he said, right? As you say, he said, I would not have done it. It's clear he wasn't claiming that he had those thoughts at the time of sentencing. He was saying, well, here's what I would have thought had it been presented that way. Is that really an exercise of discretion? I'm not sure. A person's sort of casting back to what he might have done had the facts that as he understood them been different. I think that is a little bit different from saying, okay, you're asking me to exercise my discretion, and I'm exercising it for this reason. And of course, as you know, our position is that that was not an adequate exercise of discretion. Does that answer your question? I'm trying.
Yeah, thanks.
How do you define the exercise of discretion?
I think this court has said, I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but it's something along the lines of, it involves a process of reasoning, application of the correct law to, understood facts. The reason that we say that this is not an adequate exercise of discretion is sort of a subset. It's not, it's a subset of that in that this court has said that a trial judge is not permitted to sort of have a blanket policy on any aspect of sentencing, and it said that in Ogden.
So it's the phrase I only authorize?
Pardon?
It's the phrase I only authorize?
Something like that, or I only give it in substance abuse crimes, something along those lines. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was
right.
Something like...
He said it's not a substance abuse crime. I only authorize a substance abuse program
right.
When it directly goes to the
right.
Criminogenic factors.
I take that... Right. Sorry.
I have it in front of me, so I just want to make sure you were talking about
gotcha. This
part.
All right. Thank you.
I wasn't trying to trick you.
I appreciate that. Unlike with Kalal.
Kalal. Kalal people.
You
can all do it. You can all do it.
Let's just turn to you. I think that I have said all I would like to say, unless there are further questions from the bench.
I do have further questions because we've mostly had a discussion about what our proper approach should be, but I wanted to delve a little bit more into what exactly you're arguing our statutory analysis should be in construing the meaning of two or more separate occasions. As I understand your argument, there has to be some temporal distinction or gap or lapse. Is it between the time that the defendant is convicted? Is the temporal gap between the conduct or the acts? Could you explain what your position is specifically?
Sure. It's the former. It's the time between convictions, because that's what the words of the statute say. They say on two or more separate occasions been convicted. It doesn't say on two or more separate occasions committed offenses. You know, someone robs a bank on April 1st, and then the jury finds him guilty on October 1st. We don't say he was convicted on April 1st. We say he was convicted on October 1st. And I guess that question just leads me to, I don't think we get into policy here, but to the extent the state has made some arguments about policy, I don't think it's a surprising or unusual notion that a person who has been convicted and then been punished and then been released if they went to prison and then reoffended is someone who is probably more dangerous than a person that has not followed that course. And that's why I think the notion of requiring convictions on separate occasions is an utterly commonplace notion.
So, Mr. Hinkle, under that, were you done?
Could I just have one follow-up, yep. Please? It might be more
than
one. But just to follow this line, I want to take your statutory construction to the logical conclusion as applied for your client. So he was convicted. There were five counts, right? He was convicted of each one, right?
He pled to five. There were 10 in the complaint.
In the same proceeding.
Correct.
So if we would adopt your construction of the statute, wouldn't the prosecutor then simply charge the counts separately? In other words, introduce separate proceedings into the mix in order for lifetime registration to kick in as mandatory?
I mean, I suppose there would always be ways to sort of game any rule that would come out of this. You know, the state points out, well, what if they had been in two separate counties? To me, that just shows that there's no simple, perfect rule that's going to, you know, make every case come out perfectly logically in relation to every other case. I don't know. I think if that case comes down the line, we'll see. I don't think that prosecutors, as a general matter, are looking to put everyone on the sex offender registry for life. In fact, I think, you know, it's an opportunity, again, for bargaining. I think, you know, probably most prosecutors don't think that someone who is convicted at 34 one time needs to be on the sex offender registry when he's 95.
And I don't think that, you know, whether it's gaming or not, I don't think that that's sort of an oddity or would be an irregular possibility, because it is oftentimes that there, especially with these sorts of offenses, that there are multiple counts. So if in the prosecutor's discretion he or she thought this person really should register as a sex offender for life for the protection of the public, you know, you can call it gaming, but it might also be and the reason I'm asking this is because we're supposed to give, you know, reasonable meaning to the statute, not what the legislature intended, but I'm trying to grapple with, is that the most reasonable meaning to give to the statute?
I mean, yes, I think the meaning is, as I said, that simultaneous convictions don't count. I don't know where the line is. You know, the United States Supreme Court recently had Wooten last term, where they said a person who had broken into one storage unit and then gone through the wall of that storage unit to the next one and then the next one and the next one hadn't done those things on different occasions. And they said, you know, of course there are going to be line drawing problems, but this is clearly on that side of the line. I would say the same thing here. There could be line drawing problems down the road. You know, what if their two hearings are an hour apart? Yeah, but that's not this case. But no, I agree with you. I mean, that's what trial lawyers do, right? They negotiate, they act in the shadow of the law that this court, that the legislature passes and that this court construes.
So are you done? So what I'm hearing you say, when you say simultaneous convictions, do you mean a conviction within the same hearing? Because the situation I'm thinking about, and I understand this isn't the facts of this case, but in all fairness, this is whatever we decide is going to have to be applied throughout the state. And I certainly presided over a number of cases in this area where you would have two cases, right? You'd have there would be one case, and let's say the first case, two counts are charged out, and the second case, the third case is charged out. And in the interest of efficiency, I would call those cases at the same time, and oftentimes I would hold the plea hearing on those three then convictions at the same time. You know, temporally, I think you could argue I was finding someone guilty three different times in that hearing. But are you saying, is that simultaneous if it's in the same hearing? I'm not sure. I think, like, Justice Rebecca Bradley is asking you to do, and I think Justice Hagedorn also, like, if we have to write a rule here, what's the rule going to be?
I really think that this court can rely on the definition or on the notion of separate occasions. And I think, to me, same hearing is the same occasion, you know, just in the same way that in my grocery store example, like, if I buy, instead of buying two apples, say I buy an apple and an orange, you know, the checker rings them out sequentially, not at literally exactly the same time, I would say I bought them on the same occasion. So I think the same hearing is probably the same occasion. But, you know, certainly that would be something for the next person up here to argue, I guess.
But each case and each count, each case would require a guilty plea on each count, and the court would have to determine that the person was knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily pleading to that count. So in order to have them to be separate occasions, in your reading,
if that's what they wanted to have happen, they would have to say, we're going to enter a plea in this case on Monday, come back on Tuesday and enter a plea on this case, and Wednesday a plea on this case, Thursday, Friday, and then we would like you to order a PSI for sentencing on all of the cases instead of a common practice of bringing them all in, dismissing, reading in some, having various negotiations happen, and then almost always a global recommendation regarding all counts in five cases, could be more. But they would have to be done on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to be separate occasions.
Yeah, or what if you had one scheduled at 9, one case scheduled at 9, and one scheduled at 9:30? Are those two separate occasions or
That'd
two
be
separate
like
hearings?
Going back in the store later that day and buying a banana.
Because you
is
forgot.
Not what we have here.
Forgot the banana.
I'm not sure. So do you have an answer to my question? Is that how it would have to? Because that is not the way things go right now.
No, that's not the way things go. And again, I mean, that. I suppose if a prosecutor was absolutely intent on mandatory lifetime registration rather than simply asking the judge to order lifetime registration, there would be options available. I don't think practically, once again, I don't think most prosecutors in this state are dead set on putting everyone on the registry for life. And even if they are...
I mean, this has more ramifications than this one case. This is a term of art, really, in the repeater statute. And so I'm trying to figure out how this works on the ground for trial judges and prosecutors because and defense lawyers, because you want to know what it is that's changing. And that would be a big change on the ground, at least in my experience of doing a number of sentencings where it's kind of a global recommendation concerning maybe a stack of cases.
Sure. And I guess... to be clear, I mean, we're not asking for an overruling of Whitrock and Hopkins as to 93962. It may be, as the state says, that the legislative acquiescence as to that statute is particularly strong, and also, you know, no one has brought that case here. I don't think finding that on two or more separate occasions means on two or more separate occasions in this statute is going to, you know, blow up misdemeanor negotiations or misdemeanor resolutions across the state, or misdemeanor repeaters, rather. And I can see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin where you just ended. And when parties come here asking this court to interpret a statute, we want to leave knowing the answer. And the problem with Rector's position is he actually never tells you what the term means. He does the opposite. He tells you what it doesn't mean. He says it can't possibly mean simultaneous. We've come up with many examples that create lots of confusion and leave uncertainty in the law.
Counsel, part of his answer, I think, is that all we have to hold in this case is that five counts in the same case are not separate occasions, right? I mean, granted, there are other questions that will come, but that sort of line drawing is pretty normal in our statutes. I'm not sure we need to figure out all the hard questions. I have a related question. How do you define separate occasions? What work do you see it doing in this statute?
The state believes it has a legally understood meaning from Hopkins and Whitrock. And Hopkins confronted the exact problem
which
this court.
Which is what?
Which is that the occasion referred to is the conviction itself. And so separate occasions is separate convictions. That's what this court articulated in Hopkins. And it creates clarity. We leave this courtroom knowing what it means. In Rector's example, we know what it doesn't mean, but we don't know what it does mean. And we don't have to have a lot of crazy hypotheticals. You know, Rector downloaded images on five separate occasions on three different dates. The first two times, he just downloaded a single image. If someone else had done what Rector did, but download a child being sexually assaulted at their house and then goes to work in another county and downloads it on their phone, they're now in two counties, and they're on the sex offender registry for life for two images. Rector downloads thousands of images on five separate occasions, and he's only at 15 years.
Actually, the more I'm thinking through this, if convictions, the occasions relate to the conviction, wouldn't the state then just, instead of charging five counts, you'd have five different cases?
That's the danger. And there's all sorts of oddities. You know, one I was thinking through is what happens when two co-defendants sexually assault two different women? And one strategically decides to join their cases, and one strategically decides to keep them separate. The one who joins them goes to a single court proceeding and pleads guilty to the two counts. The other pleads guilty or takes them to trial. These two defendants, who had separate cases, sexually assaulted two separate women, did so on separate dates. And because one strategically joined their cases, they face a different registry than the co-defendant who strategically decided not to. We don't need that ambiguity because this court has provided clarity in Whitrock and Hopkins. And I do want to push back one thing about the concept that the legislature doesn't know in practice the other statutes on the books. One thing the legislative history can do is confirm the plain language analysis. And what we know is Senator Darling had a concept. She had an idea. She had a DOC report that she gave to the LRB, the Legislative Reference Bureau, and a drafting attorney wrote the statute. This isn't sometimes what we see, like an advocacy group using national language and saying, make this the law in Wisconsin. So absolutely one would think that a legislator saying, here's what I want. I want people with two convictions to register for life. And that legislative drafting attorney does a simple search of the law and finds, hey, this court has interpreted this term very recently. So we should start and end with the presumption here because it creates harmony. We shouldn't look for confusion and contradiction. And I have to emphasize that this isn't a narrow definition and a broad definition. This is a contradictory definition. If we accept Rector's premise, separate occasions in one operative statute counting convictions would mean X, and another statute with the same operative structure counting convictions would mean Y. It would mean separate convictions means black in one case and white in another. It would mean day in one case and night in the other. We don't get there unless someone overcomes the presumption. That's why we've had this principle for harmony within the law for over 100 years. It goes back, as I said, it was something lawyers relied upon as far back as Abraham Lincoln advising Beloit landowners. So all the state is asking this court to do is follow its doctrine. We have a presumption. Rector could have shown why context and history justifies a contradictory meaning in the law. He chose not to. And that is where we should end. We should end with harmony and knowledge of the law. The same thing Lincoln relied on in 1856, the same thing this court relied on in 1903, the same thing this court relied on in Yakich in 2022. So we can leave court with a clear understanding of what separate occasions means in all instances, which is what this court did in Hopkins, that the occasion referred to is the occasion of conviction. And then we don't have long evidentiary hearings and future decisions teasing out the meaning. And I see my time's expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for interesting oral argument this morning. The court is adjourned. We will reconvene for the second argument and second case.